Well, come on, all of you big strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why. We'll be all gonna die. Now come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. I man, this is war, a go-go. There's many...
Jane Fonda was born in New York City to actor Henry Fonda and socialite Frances Ford Seymour, and was named Lady Jane Seymour Fonda on December 21, 1937. Jane Fonda was 12 years old when her mother died unexpectedly. Her brother Peter Fonda, who was born in 1940, and her niece Bridget Fonda, who was born in 1964, are also actors. She has an older half-sister, Frances Brokaw, as well as an adopted sister, Amy, who was born in 1953. Jane is a two-time Academy Award-winning actress, writer, political activist, former fashion model, and fitness guru. Before starting her acting career, Jane Fonda was a fashion model, gracing the cover of Vogue magazine twice. She became interested in acting in 1954 while appearing with her father in a charity performance of The Country Girl at the Omaha Community Theater. After attending Vassar College in New York, she was introduced by her father to the renowned drama teacher Lee Strasberg in 1958 and subsequently joined his actor's studio for her training. Since the 1960s, Jane Fonda has appeared in numerous movies, including They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, Barbarella, Julia, The China Syndrome, Cat Ballou, The Electric Horseman, and 9 to 5, just to name a few. She has co-starred with such noted actors as Robert Redford, Anthony Perkins, Donald Sutherland, Michael Douglas, Jack Lemmon, John Voight, Katharine Hepburn, and of course, her own father, Henry Fonda. Jane won 2 Academy Awards as Best Actress. She won her first Academy Award for Best Actress in 1971, playing a prostitute, Bree Daniel, in the detective murder mystery Clute with Donald Sutherland. It is generally acknowledged by critics worldwide that her finest acting moment on screen is her extraordinary scene towards the end of Clute, where she is confronted by her potential killer. Her second Academy Award was in 1978 for Coming Home with John Voight, which is the story of a disabled Vietnam War veteran's difficulty in re-entering civilian life, her husband's inability to deal with life after Vietnam, and her own personal struggle for identity and love. She has also received several other awards and nominations. She initially announced her retirement from acting in 1991 and said for many years that she would never act again, but she returned to film in 2005 with a major hit, Monster in Law, which she co-starred with Jennifer Lopez. Jane Fonda became very selective by the end of the 1960s, turning down lead roles in Rosemary's Baby and Bonnie and Clyde, films that were widely praised by critics and considered box office successes. She also produced and starred in several exercise videos released between 1982 and 1995. Jane Fonda has served as an activist for many political causes. One of the most notable and notorious was her opposition to the Vietnam War. In April 1970, Fred Gardner, Jane Fonda, and Donald Sutherland, with inspiration from Howard Levy, formed the FTA Tour, which stood for Free the Army, a play on the troop expression, Fuck the Army, an anti-war roadshow designed as an answer to Bob Hope's USO Tour. The tour, referred to as Political Vaudeville by Jane Fonda, visited military towns of the United States with the goal of establishing a dialogue with soldiers about upcoming deployments to Vietnam. The dialogue was made into a movie entitled FTA that contained strong, frank criticism of the war by both servicemen and servicewomen. It was released in 1972. Jane Fonda was also instrumental in helping her longtime friend David Zeiger realize his dream of telling the buried story of the GI anti-war movement that brought the end of the Vietnam War sooner than Washington wanted in its critically acclaimed documentary, Sir, No Sir, which Ebert and Ropert gave 2 thumbs up. You can find out about this outstanding movie by going to www.sirnosir.com. I also want to take this opportunity to thank David Zeiger, who has become a great friend, and for arranging the interview between Jane and myself. Jane has also protested the Iraq War and just recently participated in the huge anti-war rally in Washington, D.C., with fellow actors Sean Penn, Tim Robbins, and Susan Sarandon. She is also an outspoken activist on violence against women. She describes herself as a liberal and a feminist. Since 2001, Jane has been a Christian. In 2005, Jane released her autobiography, My Life So Far. The book describes her life as a series of three acts, each 30 years long, and declares that her third act will be her most significant, due in part to her commitment to the Christian religion, and that it will determine the things that she will be remembered for. Jane also claims that her autobiography shows that she is much more than what people think they know her as. Jane's autobiography was praised by the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, and several other major newspapers. Jane has held book signing events all over the United States since publishing her book. Love her or hate her, Jane Fonda has never been one to run away from a cause that she believes in or to bury her head in the sand and do absolutely nothing about injustices that she sees in the world. This interview you're about to hear is not scripted and will not be edited. It will be heard just as Jane and I do it. Although I have written some notes about the questions I'm going to ask her, Jane and I are going one-on-one. There are no buffers, agents, bodyguards, or publicists to tell her what to say or what not to say. This is Jane Fonda, up close and personal. Okay, I'm talking with Jane Fonda. Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
David, I'm great. Thanks.
Good. I really appreciate the time because you have fans all over the world, and a lot of people just want to hear in your own words, you know, how things are and how you feel about things as opposed to reading what the press says or whatever comes out of Washington, D.C., if you know what I mean. Okay, let's get into it. I want to talk a little bit about your background because a lot of people are really interested to see if any of the background had anything to do with how you became an activist. I know your mother died when you were 12. You know, when people lose a father or a mother, it really impacts them. I'm just wondering how it affected your life when you lost your mom.
Okay, you've asked me two questions. How did my lead to my becoming an activist, and how did my mom, who committed suicide when I was 12, did that affect me? Well, you can't help but lose a parent, especially to suicide, and not have it impact you, but the activism, I think my father was not someone that talked a lot. You know, he wasn't somebody that would set you on his knee and about life and values and things like that. But he made movies. It was Henry Fonda, and in the movies were Grapes of Wrath and Young Mr. Lincoln and The Oxbow Incident and 12 Angry Men, very often movies that have to do with justice, racial justice, legal justice, and human decency. And so because I worshiped what he didn't say to me directly, communicated to me through his movies. He didn't probably think of it in those terms, but I wanted to be like him. So the characters that he played were people that I aspired to be like. And so I think when the Vietnam War, it called up those qualities.
Is there obviously a lot of pressure when you grow up in a Hollywood family, isn't it?
Well, there can be, but I was certainly not particularly aware of it. My father was a low-key kind of guy. We always lived relatively simply, so I wasn't particularly aware of being a Hollywood brat. actually, I was a tomboy. My role model was a Lone Ranger and sometimes Tonto and forth, and trying to be brave and strong and ride horses bareback at top speed and things like that. You know, I didn't think too much about Hollywood.
Okay, well, was there anything that you can think of that you saw or observed and you decided that you were no longer going to just stand on the sidelines, that you were going to be a participant of the process rather than just being an observer?
I assume you're referring to the Vietnam War. Yes. I was living in France for 8 years. I'd married a Frenchman. I don't know whether people are aware of this or not, but, you know, long about 67, 68, a number of U.S. servicemen were resisting the war and finding their way to Paris. And one of them, whose name is Dick Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N, sought me out because he was trying to raise money so that he and his fellow resistors could get medical care, you know, dentals. And so that's how I met Dick. We kind of got to know each other, and in fact, I took he and some of his buddies to see a screening of Barbarella before it was. One day he gave me a copy of a book by Jonathan Schell, S-C-H-E-L-L, called The Village of Ben Suk, E-N-S-U-C. And it wasn't a very long book, and it was talking about a particular a battle in the Iron Triangle. And I read it in one sitting, and it just rocked me to my core. I had managed to remain rather ignorant of what was going on in Vietnam. Ignorance is comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, once you see the facts of something, you have a choice. You can turn away, which makes you a scoundrel, or you have to own it and own the pain and do something about it. And I read the book, and, you know, I grew up. My father was in the Second World War in the Pacific. He was a lieutenant in the Navy and won a Bronze Star. And I grew up thinking that wherever our soldiers were was the side of the angels. So when I read this book, I realized that what we were doing in Vietnam was really betraying what this country was supposed to stand for, betraying the kind of values that my father reflected in his movies, the kind of things that he had fought for in the Second World War. I began then to read more. It was right after the Bertrand Russell War Crimes Tribunal in Stockholm, and I read that, and then I left and came home. I came home, and as I was searching for the most effective way that I could participate in the anti-war movement, I was contacted by some people that had started the coffee house movement. Now, coffee houses were civilian-run places outside of military bases where GIs could come and hear people speak about the war, about all kinds of different things.
Right.
And they could talk and they could hang out and they could study, including studying the history of Vietnam. They asked me because I was planning to drive across the country because I'd been away for so long, I wanted to get to know my country again. And they said, well, why don't you visit the coffee houses as you go across the country? And I did. In the course of that trip, the invasion of Cambodia, the shooting of the students at Kent State, that all went down. So, you know, here I was, a sort of wet behind the ears, not so young, I was 31, person who wanted to throw my lot in with the people that were trying to end the war at a time of huge upheaval. I mean, there was really the feeling that the world was going to end, or that our country as we knew it was maybe going to end. And of course, I had left France, and it was 1968. I'd left France at a time when that government was almost overthrown by a coalition of students and workers in what's called the events of May 68, And I went from military base to military base, sometimes just the coffee houses, but sometimes I would actually go onto the bases and talk to guys. Fort Carson, I got smuggled onto base and into the stockade. And the things that I was hearing from GIs was just amazing to me. The feelings that were felt against not wanting to go to war, a lot of them, you know, they didn't have a choice, you know, for all kinds of reasons. Came from military families. They didn't see an option in terms of going to Canada. They felt an obligation to go, but they didn't like it, and they didn't like what they'd heard when people were coming back, what they were hearing. And a lot of guys were being denied their rights. You know, GIs do have rights.
All exactly.
GI stands for government issue. Yes, they become government issue, but still there is the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which I read from cover to cover, and I realized that a lot of them didn't even know they had rights. So I got involved in the GI movement to support and get the word out about guys inside the military who were being harassed and denied their rights because of their opposition to the war. I then opened, with the help of a Green Beret named Donald Duncan, we opened an office in Washington called the GI Office, which received, my God, 1,000 a week calls and letters who were crying for help, and we would process these and get them to Congress, and congressional members wanted to know what was going on and would hold hearings and everything like that. And so that was my entry into the anti-war movement.
Okay, Jane, let's talk about FTA. I know a lot about FTA because of our friendships with David Zeiger, and that's when I first really learned. I think I had heard about it, but I didn't really have a really in-depth view of FTA.
I was asked to speak at that rally to represent the GI movement. which is ironic given everything that's happened subsequently and how the right wing likes to portray me as being anti-soldier. But I was the one that spoke to that rally saying, you know, men in uniform understand the war far better than we do, and they are not the enemy of the peace movement, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, shortly after that, I was in New York filming Clute. During that filming, Dr. Howard Levy, who had become a kind of hero in the GI movement for refusing to train medics going over to Vietnam, he came to see me. Donald Sutherland was with me, and he suggested that we do a show that was like a counterpart to the Bob Hope Show, and he even suggested the name, FTA. And we thought it was a great idea, and we agreed. So that was how it originated.
Surely there had to be some kind of obstacles when you decided to do this, Jane. I mean, what obstacles did you guys have to overcome?
We didn't really. Ideally, we wanted to be able to go and perform in South Vietnam like Bob Hope did. You know, I wrote a letter to President Nixon telling him, asking permission to go. Of course, I didn't hold my breath expecting a letter. Dear Jane, sure, we'd love to have it. But, you know, so in fact, we knew that we probably wouldn't be able to go into South Vietnam, but we planned to tour the bases in the U.S., which we did. And then I raised enough money to take us overseas. We started in Hawaii and then the Philippines, Okinawa, and Japan, and played to Army and Navy Marine bases there.
It became a movie and became very popular, and there was a lot of them sold, I understand.
Idea.
The documentary that you guys did.
I don't know. A friend of mine who was a specialist in military law, Ken Cloak, went to the Philippines shortly after we came back, and he said it was amazing how many bootleg copies of FDA were circulating, and new coffee houses had opened up, and it really, I mean, we had thousands, in one instance, 10,000 guys and women come to the shows, and very often the brass would try to, derail it by announcing that we'd canceled or giving the wrong time or the wrong place.
Right.
So we would just wait until the GIs just found out where we were and would come. Wait. Sometimes we performed in bull rings. God, in Subic Bay in the Philippines, we performed in the middle of a lake, floating swan. I mean, it was pretty wild.
Floating swan?
Yeah, there was a kind of a fake swan that formed an island in the lake, and we performed on that.
You've talked about it before in some of different things that you've mentioned and said, and especially in David's movie you talked about, Rita Martinson. Tell me about Rita Martinson and how she affected the troops and that you were observant to.
Well, Rita was an actress and a singer whom I had known before through my organizing in Hollywood. So she came with us, an African-American woman with a sweet voice, and she wrote a song called Dear Soldier, We Love You. And I used to love to stand so that I could see the faces of the soldiers when she sang that in the show. And I'll never forget this one young guy in the front row. There were tears coming down his face when she sang. It's a very moving, beautiful song.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, when I saw David's Sir No Sir movie and actually got a chance to see the clips that he put in there from the FTA movie, I mean, when they panned into the audience and you could just see the tears streaming down the troops' face, it was almost like they had a validation that someone cared.
Yeah, that's right. And all the material that we used in the FTA show, was just why I love Sir No Sir, because somebody could say that we were trying to incite the troops or something like that. The fact is that all the material that we used in the show came from the guys themselves, from the newspapers that they would put out.
The underground press, in other words. Mm-hmm. Let's go into, I'm sure, something that, you know, becomes part of every single conversation you ever have to get involved in. And I know it gets to be boring, but since we're going worldwide and this is going to be kind of live on forever, if you will, to say unequivocally once and for all, and address the Hanoi Jane thing. You go to Hanoi with the intent to document and prove, which you were validated with that, and not everybody knows that, it's part of the record, that Richard Nixon was going to bomb the dams and flood and kill innocent people. And was that not your main intent to go to Hanoi to begin with?
Yes, I went in July of 1972. The prior spring of 72, American anti-war movement was getting reports from French and Swedish reporters, journalists, and diplomats that they had witnessed U.S. planes bombing the dikes of North Vietnam, that it was a crisis. Let me just briefly explain why. North Vietnam is below sea level, like Holland, and
In New Orleans.
Yeah. Basically, it's made livable by a series of earthen dikes that have been built over centuries by peasants with their by hand because they don't have heavy equipment. A very intricate network of earthen dikes, without which they'd be flooded. With the dikes, they were able to grow crops. It held off starvation. The dikes apparently being targeted before monsoon season, and they were being bombed with fragmentation bombs so that you couldn't, aerial photographs wouldn't show a bomb crater. These are rather small devices, these fragmentation bombs, that enter at a slant the base of the dike and then explode inside, weakening the dike, so that during monsoon seasons the dikes would give way. We were desperate. Later, you know, with the Pentagon, with the publication of the Pentagon Papers, we saw that this was something, the bombing of the dikes had been proposed to President Johnson when he was president, and he had said, no, we can't be responsible for such a thing. Apparently, Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State, said that had they given way, 200,000 people could have drowned. The Undersecretary of Defense under Johnson said up to 1 million people could drown. I mean, it was a big deal. So that's when I decided that almost 300 Americans of all stripes, you know, congressional people, Vietnam veterans, journalists, peace activists, religious people, had gone to North Vietnam. But not at all, you know, the first. Hundreds went. And I decided that my going would bring more attention to it because of my celebrity. So I arranged to go. My mistake was that I went alone. I broke my foot in the airport in Paris on the way. Not only was I alone, I broke my foot and we landed in Moscow en route to Laos and then Laos to Hanoi. In Moscow, I had to be taken to a hospital where they put a cast on my foot. So when I arrived in Hanoi, I was on crutches with a cast on my foot, making me extremely vulnerable to the air raids and so forth. But anyway, you know, I had my camera. Right before I got there, a French film crew had filmed the bombing of a dike that they were actually on. There was a lot going on. I got back and showed the film and everything to at a press conference, both in Paris and in the United States. And a month later, there was no more bombing of the dikes. Now, the Nixon administration has denied at the time that this was happening. I can't prove, no one could prove that they were deliberately trying to destroy the system of dikes. One thing that's been put forward as a possibility is that they wanted to prove to the North Vietnamese that they were capable of doing that unless the North Vietnamese knuckled under at the negotiating table. You know, we don't know. But at any rate, the bombing of Dyke stopped a month after I got back.
You know, of course, the famous picture, you sitting on the anti-aircraft gun.
It was my last day in Hanoi. And interestingly, before I ever left the United States, the Vietnamese sent me a proposed itinerary that included a visit to a military site. And I wrote back and I said, I'm not interested in that. You know, no. But they went ahead and scheduled me to do that. Believe me, I was there for 2 weeks, and by the end of it, I was an emotional rag. The stuff that I had seen, not just the suffering and the bombing, which bombs fell close to where I was, and the experiences in the air raid shelters with Vietnamese. I mean, it was mind-blowing, the things that I experienced while I was there, but also very uplifting things. My whole life was turned on end, and I should have just put my foot down and say, no, I'm not going to go there, but I kind of went, I was limp by now, and I went. And I got there, it was outside of Hanoi, and there was a group of soldiers. They were really young. I kept thinking of my brother. And they sang me a song that was translated to me by the translator. And the song included, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all people are created equal. Ho Chi Minh had read the Declaration of Independence and thought it was so beautiful that he had incorporated it to the Vietnamese Declaration of Independence. It was in the song that the soldiers, and I was crying and I was laughing, and they asked me to sing a song. Actually, I had memorized a Vietnamese song. I had Vietnamese friends here, and so I sang this Vietnamese song, slaughtering it, obviously, because it's a very difficult language to communicate. And people were laughing, and I was laughing at myself and clapping, and I was kind of just led over, and I sat down all the while, soldiers laughing, me laughing and clapping, and boop, click, photograph taken. And it wasn't until I got up and started to walk away that I realized, oh, my God. And I asked my translator, I said, you've got to have those photographs destroyed. There must have been 20 journalists around, and, I mean, I was naive, right, to think that they were going to do that. It occurred to me that they would so quickly find their way back. But what is interesting, and I write about it at length in my book, when I got back, there was only one small paragraph about it in the New York Times. It was no big deal. It wasn't until the Reagan administration that the myth of Hanoi Chain using that photo was created and has been used ever since.
Yeah, and, you know, I find it really amazing how one photograph can be such a focal point, and it really has become a focal point for the people that really are diehard anti-Jane people. You know, some people see it and they go, you know, hey, you know.
Well, not aided and abetted by the lies that have been spread about me on the Internet. Horrible things. It's been debunked. Bill O'Reilly had to apologize for repeating it. It continues to this day.
But you know, Corey Dietz in AboutRadio.com, I found an interesting article where it had Jane Fonda, Myth or Fact. And I thought it was such an interesting article that I put it up on the dedicated forum that I have with some of my partners at AboveTopSecret.com and just left it there on the forums to get people's input on what they thought about the fact or fiction part of it. And it completely debunks that entire email thing. In fact, quoting whoever was supposedly the one that said it, that he said, you know, I never said that. You know, I never met Jane Fonda. And I mean, it was just a pretty...
Yep, continues anyway.
Yeah, but you know, but it's like anything, you know, and I mean, and I understand exactly what you're saying, but it's like anything. If people can't let go of something, Jane, they're not going to let go of it. You know, you can sit there and show them all the proof in the world, but, you know, you can't change people's beliefs sometimes, which is unfortunate.
Some people, yeah.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate.
Not all people.
Okay, let's move on into some of the more fun things, which I am really excited about. And the very first one is Barbarella. You become a sex goddess. You become a pinup poster, a Betty Grable, if you will, to GIs all over the world and men all over the world, I might add. I remember seeing that movie. In fact, I saw that movie, if I'm not mistaken, when I was in Vietnam. You know, obviously, people fell in love with Jane Fonda at the time.
Well, that's nice.
It's a, you know, great movie. When I bought it, I bought, you know, several of them just to refresh my mind about them. I saw John Philip Law, and John Philip Law became a kind of a noted actor to a degree and did several interesting things, but the one that really amazed me was Ugo Toganazzi. And Ugo was in all the famous La Cage La Folle movies. And I thought, you know, that guy really looks familiar. And then it dawned on me who he was. Okay, you know, they're talking about doing a remake of Barbarella. I don't know if you've been keeping up with it. Some people have asked, if you had a choice and with today's actresses, they're young actresses, who would maybe be some of the top runners for the Barbarella?
Oh, I guess Angelina Jolie comes to mind.
That would be a good choice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, China Syndrome. You're a reporter with Michael Douglas. You co-star with Michael Douglas and Jack Lemmon. Movies with a message. Wasn't then 3 Mile Island happened. I mean, it seemed like at the time of your career, you were choosing movies that had a message.
Yeah, well, I produced them. I co-produced that one with Michael Douglas, but I co-produced Coming Home, which was voted by veterans as the movie that portrayed them the best, you know, that they felt depicted them most fairly, 9 to 5, and a lot of the movies that I did along in that time I produced.
So you basically picked movies that you thought would be fun or would bring a point home or whatever,
yeah.
Right? Okay, well, speaking of 9 to 5, I mean, it was a comedy. So people have always asked, do you prefer comedy or drama when you're producing or involved in a movie project?
Depends on what format will the best carry the concept. We thought that it would be fun to cover that subject about the realities of office workers by a comedy. And frankly, I like to do comedy. My last film, Monster in Law, did very, very well, and I love doing that. It's, you know, it's hard to get a good comedy.
And you mentioned, of course, Clute. I thought it was just outstanding when you portrayed Brie Daniel, and you're co-starring with Donald Sutherland. I read something that didn't surprise me, but critics worldwide say that the very last scene of Klute, your very top of your game at that stage, that it was absolutely one of the most stunning acting portrayals that anybody had seen at that time. And it's an amazing scene. I thought the whole movie was amazing, Jane. I really did. Okay, Coming Home, you mentioned it earlier, but you're co-starring with John Voight and Bruce Dern. I have to honestly admit, I didn't see it originally. I bought it on DVD, and when I saw it, I was just really deeply rooted into the portrayal of it, about the fact that returning veterans were not getting all the things that they needed in the VA hospitals. I saw you torn between trying to find love and where you were in your own life, because you were a very strong person and portrayed in that movie, between, you know, helping a guy that you know, thought his life was at end and then really found some significance with you. And then Bruce Dern, of course, being your husband coming back, and then, you know, not being able to deal with it. And boy, talk about true life stories.
Well, that's because we did a lot of research. I was friends with Ron Kovic, and when Ron was down in the VA hospital in Long Beach, I remember it was the 4th of July, he invited me down there to meet with the vets that were at the VA hospital, and I tape recorded what they told me, and then I sent the writers also talk to them, and a lot of what we learned there and in other rap groups, a guy named Shad Meshad, who has spent most of his life as a psychologist working with veterans suffering from PTSD, and myself and the writer of Coming Home went to a lot of the rap groups and listened to the vets, and a lot of that found its way into the script. That's why it seems real life.
It really blew me away, because I really could identify with it, with my own friends, my own three tours in Vietnam, and just things that I had learned. But it was really a great movie. Well, I started out at Cameron Bay, then went from there to Phan Rang, and then went to Saigon, and that's where I started the Radio First Termer program on January 1st through the 21st. And then, of course, stopped because we didn't want to go.
Vietnam.
Yeah, didn't want to go to prison. All right, let's talk about the final movie, and then we'll move on to Sir, No Sir. And that is, it's one of my all-time favorites, and that's on Golden Pond, where you are actually portraying yourself, really, to a degree, with your dad. And there's a lot of issues that are portrayed in the film. And I really identified with it because I, too, like you, had some real problems with my real father. I have had a stepfather that I dearly loved, but my real dad and I really had some issues. And when I saw the movie, I said, boy, does that ring a bell? And it really struck a chord with me.
Yeah, with lots of people, it's why it did so well. Of all the movies I've made, that's the one people will walk across the street to tell me that, you know, that they saw the movie and then they brought their dad to see it and it changed their relationship. Or yeah, it was an incredible movie. I produced that movie.
And the thing that I most enjoy about DVDs is the behind-the-scenes stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's one thing to see a movie, but it's another thing to sit there and see you talking about how Katharine Hepburn kind of gave you some help when you're doing the boat scene with your dad. It was such an emotional thing, I'm sure, to be really portraying a real father-daughter thing. But you look over and you say, you know, I see Katharine Hepburn and she's got her fist clenched, you know, and you turn around and you do this magnificent scene with your dad, which just really, really impactful.
It is, yeah. One of my favorite chapters in my book, My Life So Far, is the one called On Golden Pond. It really captures what we went through. It was a fabulous experience.
And then the other thing on the behind-the-scenes thing, and I have to admit, boy, I'm an old softy when it comes to certain things. When Mark Rydell, the director of the movie and a friend of yours, is talking about when you call and you say, Mark, you know, Dad doesn't have a long time. If you've got it to a point where he can see it, you know, we really need to do that. And and Mark talks about how your dad and somebody is, you know, with him, and he's watching the movie, and the movie's over, and Mark Rydell gets up and goes back, and your dad's kind of coming along, and then kind of throws himself on Mark Rydell and makes the comment that just, you know, really was the something that was so important to him. And then, of course, Mark Rydell's got tears streaming down his face, and he says, and he died not long after. I mean, I sat there, honest to God, Jane, and just, I identified with that, and it just was just an amazing emotional experience.
Can you understand how blessed blessed I feel that I was able to do that with my dad before he died.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, seeing you come down and accept his Oscar, and I mean, the emotional feelings that you had on stage, and you're holding it up and you're saying, okay, Dad, you did it, you know. I mean, it really kind of brought it full circle in y'all's relationship, didn't it, pretty much?
Yeah, it did.
Let's talk about one last thing then. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, just briefly, how you got started with David and Sir No Sir.
I met David in 1970, I think, when I was making the trip that I mentioned earlier across country and visiting coffee houses, and one of the coffee houses was the Oleo Strut outside of Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas, and David was on the staff of the Oleo Strut. And so that's when I met him. And then, about 3 years later, he lets me know. I mean, I've seen some of his, he's a good documentary filmmaker, and I've seen some of his documentary films. And so when he called me to say that he was going to do a documentary about the GI movement, I said, man, you know, any way I can help, let me know, because this is a part of history that was swept under the rug. And it's really important. You know, the revisionist history wants us to believe that anti-Vietnam War movement was against the troops, and the troops were all for the war, when in fact the troops were against the war in such large numbers that by 72 the military historian Robert Heinl, H-E-I-N-L, said that the army was in a state bordering on collapse. And, you know, it was really pathetic. It was very, very sad. One of the things that I've learned meeting with soldiers subsequent to the ending of the Vietnam War is so many of them blame themselves. You know, there's so many guys, it meant a lot to be in the military, you know, first generation, second generation Americans, to be able to fight for the country, a very important thing. And then we lost a war and they blame themselves. And it's so important for those soldiers to understand that, you know, we've never fielded such a good fighting force. It was not a war that could be won. It had nothing to do with the soldiers that we lost, and I hate to think that they hold that in their hearts.
So David gets with you and says, hey, I think we did, this is a story that needs to be told, and that's how you really got on board.
He had been filming and interviewing, and then I said, yeah, come on and interview me, and then I helped him fundraise. That's how it happened.
And you've done a marvelous job. Okay, one last question before we hang up. Do you think we're going to have a woman president?
Well, we will one day. You know, hopefully it'll be sooner rather than later. It's certainly possible.
Listen, I know you're rushed, and I really appreciate you blocking this time.
I appreciate your time, David. Thanks a lot.
And I can't thank you enough, Jane, for your time.
Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Well, that concludes the Jane Fonda interview. I had a lot more questions and topics that I wanted to talk with her about, but like all celebrities who are in constant demand for their time, she could only allow me 30 minutes. But considering that I was only one of three people in the world whom she even granted an interview with, I want to thank Jane for that courtesy. If you want answers to a lot of the questions that I didn't get to, they are all covered in depth in her autobiography, My Life So Far, which is available at all major bookstores worldwide. I also want to take this opportunity to thank David Zeiger, director and producer of the acclaimed documentary Sir No Sir, the Ebert and Roper, gave two thumbs up. His website is www.sirnosir.com. Please go by there and purchase the DVD directly from David's site. He also has a lot of other neat things on there that you might find of interest. I also want to take this opportunity to thank my partners in crime, the Three Amigos from AboveTopSecret.com, whose website is www.AboveTopSecret.com. I want to thank Will Snyder, my agent and attorney, and also the webmaster of the official Dave Rabbit homepage at www.RadioFirstTermer.com.VNVictorNNancy. I want to thank my partners at Podomatic, whose website is www.podomatic.com. For more music, comedy, and interviews, please visit my official podcast home at www.daverabbit.podomatic.com. I'm going to leave you with a beautiful song by Rita Martinson that she sang to thousands of troops worldwide, entitled Soldier, We Love You. Remember, You don't have to support a war to support the troops. Peace, everybody.
I read that you took a stand and refused to kill in Vietnam. You said no man was your enemy if what he's fighting for is to be free. Ghetto streets lead nowhere, and ghetto cries fill the air. Uncle Sam's in Nam to loot and rob, and people starve at home 'cause there's no jobs. Oh, ain't it hard to smile sometimes? Soldier, we love you. Yes, soldier, we love you. Standing strong, 'cause it's hard to do what you know you must do, 'cause it's true. Yes, it's true. They locked you up in their stockades. Yeah, they locked you up 'cause they're afraid that you would rap and spread the word. But you can't jail truth, it will be heard. Oh, ain't it hard to smile sometimes? I know it's hard to smile sometimes, but soldier, we love you. Yeah, brave soldier, we love you. Standing strong, yes, it's hard to do what you know you must do, 'cause it's true. Yes, it's true. And soon there will be others too who refuse to fight and stand with you. Yes, they'll raise their fists high in the air, say we're not going anywhere. Oh, ain't it hard to smile sometimes? I know it's hard to smile sometimes, but soldier, we love you. Brave soldier, we love you. Standing strong, yes, it's hard to do what you know you must do, 'cause it's true. Yes, it's true.